You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. As well, you can hear these podcasts at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. There are two publishing houses, SteinerBooks.org in America and RudolfSteinerPress.com in England, which are the sole publishers of Steiner into English and have given me permission to do these recordings. Please consider patronizing them as well. This is a reading of Collected Works, Volume 206 by Rudolf Steiner, 11 Lectures, translated by Matthew Barton, entitled The Human Being as Spiritual Being Evolving Through the Course of History. This is the last lecture in this book, Lecture 11, given in Dornach on the 20th of August, 1921. Yesterday I sought to show how humanity's state of soul or state of consciousness has changed throughout history, and also prehistory. In showing this, I wanted to help us acknowledge the necessity, if we are to gain real and substantial knowledge, of raising ourselves, in turn, to a different condition of soul from the present one. This new state of soul is different from the one to which we have become accustomed, which is cultivated today in daily life and in science, and is regarded as an absolute, as a condition that has remained constant as long as human beings have existed, and that will continue as long as human life on earth can justifiably be said to continue. If we recognize that the soul has in fact acquired a different inner condition simply through the course of humanity's historical development, then it will be easier to acknowledge the transformation that today's state of soul will undergo. To pick up the thread of what I said yesterday, I will briefly recapitulate what can be gathered from our recent reflections. I said that humanity, or what we can regard as civilization, only actually arrived at its current soul condition from the 15th century onward, a condition of soul that is intrinsically characterized, on the one hand, by our striving for an intellectual interpretation of the world, by employing reason to understand the world. This intellectual apprehension of the world, in fact, corresponds to a very specific realm or kingdom that can be encompassed and understood by means of it, the world of minerality, of mineral forms, that have not yet raised themselves to the level of life. Nowadays, there is a widespread belief that purely intellectual endeavors might eventually succeed in grasping the nature of life. But this is so only because people fail to discern the correspondence between the intellect within us and the non-living, inorganic realm in the world around us. If we look back to a time before the 15th century and consider the period stretching back from then to about the 8th century B.C., we find the human soul to have a different mode of apprehension, one best characterized by the culture of ancient Greece. Here, rather than an intellectual state of soul, we find that concepts and words have not yet been strictly detached from one another. The state of soul in ancient Greece came about largely by virtue of the fact that instead of summoning concepts with a certain degree of abstraction, as we do, it heard sound qualities, albeit not outwardly audible ones. It inwardly felt the sounds of words. What for us lives in the abstraction of concepts for the Greeks was tinged with the spiritually apprehended speech sound. By, if I may put this paradoxically, by the inaudible, purely inwardly experienced speech sound. In the same way that we live in abstract concepts, the Greeks lived in the outwardly inaudible sounds of speech. But this is what enabled them to have a living apprehension of the nature of life in the surrounding world. And we can therefore see that wherever, on these foundations, the ancient Greeks seek to form ideas about the universe, the cosmos, they do not employ the ideas that we employ, drawn from geology, physics, or chemistry, but instead draw on what has come to life in their soul through processes of the growth, development, flourishing, and fading of all plant life. If we look still further back, we come to eras that can no longer be strictly termed historical. We arrive at a time reaching from around the 3rd to the 8th millennium B.C. And if we look at the regions that might in those days have been seen as the seat of culture and civilization, we find that the essence of the soul life of these peoples can no longer be sought in inward experience of words, but instead in the imaginative shaping or forming of syntax, of speech, rhythm, and thematic sequence. That is, the way one tone follows another, penetrating the world of tone and also speech sounds, something we can only bring to life in us if we strive for a poetic fashioning of speech, was the living element of what I will call the cultured peoples of those times. Whereas the Greeks used words to express a particular outward thing or occurrence, these earlier peoples sought to have an inward sense or feeling of what they believed was living in the world everywhere as rhythm and harmony. In this era, therefore, inward rhythm, inward harmony constituted the state of the human soul. And if we ask which kingdom of nature this inner state of soul could outwardly penetrate, we find it to be the kingdom capable of experiencing sentience, inward feeling, in other words, the kingdom of animal life, the realm of sentience that lives in a sense and feeling of objective reality. This apprehension came to life in the inward state of soul of humankind in this era. Then if we go still further back, you will now have an inkling that a perception of the intrinsic nature of the human being must have been present in a certain respect. In our time, we perceive dead nature. This was preceded by a perception of living nature. And going further back, we come to times only expressed today, really, by those outlooks proceeding from a more or less enlightened Catholicism. Minds who have brought to life within them a Catholic philosophy of older times, not, of course, the decadent forms of Catholicism, speak of a primordial revelation in humanity. We have to see various things in the right light, if we are to judge these things appropriately. The Catholic Church has become something different from what it was, say, in the times of the fathers of the Catholic Church. We need look only at the works of Origen to find how he tries to inform Christian thinking with all that could be gained from philosophical contemplation in his era. Thus we find that the Church Fathers also, certainly, possessed an awareness that a primordial revelation had once existed in humanity. And there are Catholic writers today who preserve the better powers of Catholicism and still speak of the primal revelations, which later fade away into an increasingly decadent paganism, so that this knowledge gradually disappeared. In these primordial revelations, humanity received instinctively something which Christianity later brought back in a more developed form. It is interesting to see how writers such as Otto Willmann look back to the mysteries, and before them, to this primordial revelation that inspired people of the 3rd millennium B.C. and prior to it, how they seek this kind of original revelation. We do not need to describe in more detail what is said of this primal revelation, but let us characterize what spiritual science can ascertain of these prehistoric eras of human culture, an instinctive state of soul, as I will call it for now, that can discern not only the sentient element, but the intrinsically, specifically human element. In other words, something living in human nature that is higher than the animal. Yes, there was a time when human perception and knowledge was instinctive, and would not even be recognized today as knowledge at all, a kind of immediate experience, a dull, dreamlike apprehension, yet one that certainly contained something of the intrinsic nature of the human being, allowing people then to live their way inwardly into this essential nature and apprehend what intrinsically constitutes it. This epoch cannot be regarded as historical, although some historical evidence of it has been preserved. The account I now wish to give of this epoch will show you how we can regard this sparse historical evidence. In speaking of the condition of soul that is now the overriding one in modern humanity, we are speaking of something that lies within ordinary soul experience, in a more or less clear and more or less trivial sense. Even when we consider it at the period typified by ancient Greece, we speak of an inward experience of the word, thus again of something that lies within the soul realm itself. Even when we look back to the 9th or 10th century B.C., to the 2nd and end of the 3rd millennium B.C., when we observe there the element of rhythm of thematic processes and experiences in soul experience, we are still speaking of something that unfolds within the soul. Although it must also be admitted by those familiar with these things through their own powers of vision, that the moment the experiencing soul departs from the word and enters into this rhythmic experience, into this experience of harmonies, and, as I will put it, musical imaginative themes, then the corporeal element always also quietly resonates alongside what the soul experiences. In the same way that a vivid dream also involves something occurring in our bodily nature, which gives rise to the dream's configuration, so people in the era I am describing knew that when they brought harmony, rhythm, and thematic elements to life in themselves, which they experienced as the revelation of cosmic secrets, then something of their bodily nature was also quietly reverberating. When we speak of our abstract intellectual apprehension of the world, there is nothing in our awareness of any such bodily reverberation. We can conceive theories of what might be happening in the human nervous system when logical, intellectual thinking is at work, but such theories are merely conceptual, they are not alive, and are not experiential for us. It is in this same way that we must speak of the Greek soul when we picture how the word lived in this soul. But as I said, when we ascend to the preceding era, we already leave the realm of pure soul and find a quiet involvement of the corporeal element. And ascending still further back into the earlier centuries of the 3rd millennium B.C. and previous to that, we depart still further from what we nowadays call soul, and enter the corporeal realm. At that time, a direct soul experience existed, which very much possessed the character of bodily experience. In those ancient times, people experienced an occurrence that today we would certainly describe as bodily. I don't want to speak now of whether they are completely right to do so or partly wrong. A process designated corporeal, where later people came to experience soul, as we call it. Let me expressly state that in trying to enter into human experiences of this kind that differ so markedly from our own, it is difficult to find apt words. Things themselves become different from what we experience nowadays. Our languages are shaped in conformity with our modern experiences, and we have to try to use language to get back to something that is no longer directly experienced today, and that contemporary word usages can only faintly indicate. That is why I have to say that what we nowadays call soul did not actually live in the inner state of soul of these ancient peoples. There lived in them rather bodily or even corporeal experience, by contrast to our modern thinking or inward hearing of words. Thus these ancient peoples experienced inhaling, holding the breath, and breathing out, not as we do, who have grown away from living within our breathing processes. They experienced this breathing, lived within it, in the way we experience only in abnormal states. For instance, in states of anxiety, when we are dreaming, and then on awakening find that our breathing is disturbed. There, in a dysfunctional form, we can observe something of this interaction of the breathing process with the surfacing of pictures in our awareness. We have grown away from pictures appearing in consciousness in the normal process and unfolding of breathing. And this is because our perception has grown through stages, through the rhythmic element in speech, the harmony in speech, the melodious themes and intonations of speech, to the inward coloring of the word and sense in our own time, to abstract thinking, to an intellectualized thinking about the world. But these three periods were preceded by that other, by an era when the human being still lived below, if I can put it like this, in what we nowadays call bodily nature, lived with the process of cognition in what at that time was inhaling, holding of the breath, and exhaling. What did people back then experience when they breathed in? We can only discover this nowadays through the imaginative cognition I have written about in my books titled Knowledge of the Higher Worlds and title Occult Science. What people experienced in those ancient times when they breathed in was essentially an imagination, the imagination of the human being himself. When they breathed in, they experienced the imagination of the human being as form and figure. That is what they felt as they breathed in, though, of course, they had to focus their attention on this and did not always do so in the course of daily life. But they were able, in a sense, to pause daily soul life, and then they could experience this. This experience came to them, especially at moments when waking consciousness was somewhat subdued. This was necessary. Today we would say that in states close to falling asleep or waking up, they experienced the human form as the process of breathing entered them. As they held the breath, they experienced how this form joined with their inner soul nature. You can say that they possessed the ability to experience the human form as they breathed in, and as they held the breath, to experience how this form grew misty, and how this now aura-like and misty form united with the soul. Then, as they breathed out, they experienced the soul surrendering itself to the outer world, and the harmony of the human being with this surrounding world. I expressly stated that people could experience this at particular moments. They could focus their attention, in a sense, on the breathing process, and then they perceived this. In this way, they really acquired instinctive knowledge, if we can call this knowledge, by observing their breathing process, especially when they guided it inwardly a little, something they could achieve through practice. And then they gained insight into the nature of the human being. This was therefore, you can say, a descent into their corporeality, and gave them knowledge of the nature of the human being. Of course, we must not imagine that in those ancient times people were spending the whole day from morning to evening immersed in self-contemplation only. That is why I said that this only occurred when they focused their attention on it. But it was easy for them to draw forth such attention from their overall human constitution. Now, this leads us back, as I said, to very ancient times. But from those times, the breathing practices, the yoga breathing of certain schools in India, was preserved through into historical eras. In very ancient times, this existed in a primary and natural form, but was perpetuated and preserved in later epochs. When certain preparations, certain ways of handling the breathing process, became necessary to achieve it. In an early era, such methods simply arose naturally, as faculties people learned during the course of their life, just as we learn to speak today. Yoga breathing, as it is called, is the legacy of an earlier time, in which the whole human soul constitution was different from what it became later. A soul constitution in which the human being met the world in an instinctive way. It was, you see, very instinctive when people grasped the essential nature of things through their breathing, not their thinking. Whereas today we mull things over in our thoughts as we try to gather separate facts together into a whole context and seek natural laws through our rational deductions, and so on. Back then, people simply breathed in an instinctive knowledge of their essential being as it arose within human nature. It is very important to recognize that not everything remains constant in every epoch of humanity's evolution. Just as the constitution of the human soul has changed, so also, albeit in subtler ways, has our bodily constitution. It has to be said that those who believe today that they can employ a breathing process to reawaken the capacity to penetrate the world's secrets, as this was practiced in ancient times, and as it was preserved by those with a constitution different from that of modern Europeans, are barking up the wrong tree. It is necessary not only to trace the outer history of humanity's development, as was done especially in the 19th century, but also to accustom ourselves to trace inwardly the evolution of the soul that runs parallel to this outward physical evolution. We will be able to describe this outer physical evolution far better if we can, at the same time, observe human soul and spiritual evolution. You will be able to sense that if we can gain a tangible sense of these four different conditions of the human soul, then we will also be able to view the soul in a particular way. We have, first of all, a state of soul that is actually scarcely a state of soul anymore, but a bodily state, one living in the breathing process. Then, the state of soul living in rhythm and harmony, in an imaginative and thematic process. Then, the state of soul living in an inaudible experience of the word, of language, and finally the state of soul existing in the process of intellectualization. Once we have a tangible sense of all this, then we can regard the soul as possessing the capacity to engage with the world in the most diverse ways. And that is what is needed today, a knowledge that such diverse capacities or potentials exist, or let us say such diverse modes of consciousness. And that each state of consciousness reveals different levels of cosmic life and cosmic existence. There is a general view today that there is only one state of consciousness, which people then try to describe as an absolute. Yet by confining themselves to this one mode of awareness, at the same time they confine themselves to one stage or level of cosmic existence and cosmic experience. And we can indeed say that the modern state of consciousness is far removed from gaining insight into our intrinsic human nature. Instead, it clings to its efforts to construct a, in quotes, human nature from physiology and biology. What is nowadays called psychology is basically only a collection of well-worn phrases for something that no longer relates to any real content of soul. Humanity must regain an understanding of life as well as death, of sentience as well as life, of the essentially human as well as mere sentience. As I said, these observations of mine are intended to make it easier to form ideas that will lead us to what is necessary today if we are to gain knowledge once more of the reality of human nature, if we are to reacquaint ourselves with the essentially human. And this essence of human nature will not disclose itself to the state of consciousness that is primarily oriented to dead things, to the world of minerality. We speak of the ego or I, and we believe ourselves capable of doing so. But merely having a word for this I is no proof that we also endow it with real content of soul. Today there exist philosophies which regard the ego or I merely as a summation or compilation of what people experience as thought and feeling. In a sense, only a thread linking one thought to another, one feeling to another, the linkage between feeling and thought, and thus something completely abstract. This view does actually have a limited justification, but what is experienced in the soul when people speak of this kind of sense of I basically possesses no real content. Look, we can have a white surface and can speak of white. I have often used this image. We see the white, but here in the middle we also see black. There's no white there, it is absent, and nevertheless we see the black through the white. There's a drawing. If you can really analyze soul life, you will be able to see that nowadays we experience something in the soul that can be compared with this white. We experience pain and pleasure. We experience this or that feeling, love, hate, and so on. We experience thoughts, although in ordinary awareness, these are something very gray, really, when they seek to be retrospectively experienced in reflection. But with this consciousness, we experience the I in the same way as we do the black here within the white. Where we experience the void, as it were a hole in our consciousness, we place the I in ordinary consciousness. Hardly surprising, therefore, that we speak of the I. Here, too, we are speaking of the empty hole. In all that people experience during waking life, the I is absent. The question can rise up in us as to how we can find any means at all to gain ideas or pictures of the I. Yes, the person who genuinely seeks insight is then led to something else, finding in everything that surrounds us in the world no way of gaining a purchase on ideas about the I. Usually what surrounds us is sometimes outside us and sometimes within us in the soul. These are basically the same. And if we find nothing but a hole, a void for the I within us, so, likewise, under ordinary circumstances, we cannot find any place to, as it were, locate our I either. Those who earnestly seek knowledge will find a means of coming closer to the I only in one phenomena in the world, that of death. Precisely where human existence ceases, when, in a sense, the human body is surrendered to outer forces, that until death it has been withdrawn from during life since birth or conception, then if we are able to form an idea of the essentially human only now, that we have no means of defining the human being in terms of the body, it begins to be possible for us to approach the I. We have to start with the phenomenon, that is, you can say, the most inexplicable of outer phenomena, because ordinary consciousness cannot grasp it. Because it is the hardest thing to introduce into consciousness. But if we can resolve to regard death in this way, if we do something similar in the case of the phenomenon of death to what I have described as the wrestling with concepts altogether, where merely abstract cognition becomes inward experiencing, if we approach the phenomenon of death in this way, then we gradually learn to see that death, when it comes to meet us at the end of life, is really only something like a sum, or, if you like, an integral part of various processes that are always occurring in us from birth onward. Basically, we are always dying. But we are doing so, you might say, in very small increments. When we begin our life on earth, we also begin to die. But ever and again, the vitality with which we are endowed through birth overcomes death. Death is always seeking to work in us, but it never gets further than working in small increments within us and is then overcome. But what is compressed and summed up tangibly in us at the one moment of death is always working incrementally during life as an ongoing, enduring process. If we pursue this, we see that not only upbuilding, synthesizing processes are at work in the organism. If this were so, we would never be able to achieve thinking consciousness, for what is merely living, merely full of life, deprives us of consciousness, makes us insensible. The death processes in us, the processes of dying, the processes whereby vitality is annihilated, which are always incrementally at work in us, are also the ones that endow us with consciousness, making us thinking, reflecting beings. We would continually be plunged into a kind of unthinking unconsciousness if we were only alive. If it were true that life in the plant, animal, and human being merely worked at a higher level in each, if, in other words, life was simply enhanced, intensified at each level, we would never be able to develop thinking consciousness. In the plant we find life, but as this life ascends to animal existence, it is already becoming more muted. And in the human being, a continual process of dying exists, which not only mutes life, but undermines it, though it is built up again. This is the organic process underlying conscious thinking. To the same degree that we have a continual process of dying within us, we also have the capacity to think in physical life. If we learn to observe the upbuilding process, there's a drawing, the vital upbuilding process of vegetable growth, which is also at work within us. And if we can then observe how animal life mutes or curbs this upbuilding process, accompanied at the same time by a continuous lapse, an inward disintegration or decay, and if we then finally succeed in perceiving the nature of this inner disintegration, we also discover what it is that always maintains itself in the face of it. We have the process of dying, but we also have what continually combats it. And thus we discover the process that embodies the life of the I. That is where the I lives. As we behold in higher cognition how the nerve process in the human being gives rise to a continual depositing, a kind of inner sedimentation, we also behold how the I rests itself free from this sedimentation, this inner forming of sedimentary deposits. We cannot gain vision of the true I until we become able to observe this inner forming of sediments. The I lives in us quite naturally. But we perceive this I by experiencing the death process, the process of inner decomposition. Once we have grasped that the I continually combats this death process, then we also grasp that the I is something that intrinsically has nothing to do with death as such. Then we gain a tangible perception of what is otherwise regarded dialectically or logically as immortality. But this is the means to behold immortality, for thereby we reach entities who belong to a different order of existence than the sediment lapsing from life. We enter a region where death has no meaning, where it loses the possibility of forming as an earthly feeling. In this way we approach the I by studying death. I am only initially referring to this in brief terms, since this study of death is a very extensive one. For those who see value in this study, it can be said that observation of this continual sedimentation, this forming of sediment, gives rise in perception to something that appears like a continual inner flickering up of sparks of darkness. Sparks of darkness, by contrast to sparks of light, in a luminous aura that is even and uniform. But we have to form still other concepts, if we wish in turn to come close to a kind of knowledge of the human being. I have to start from something else to form this different concept. I pointed to death and its overcoming in relation to gaining a sense of the I. Now, I want to point to the following. Observe plant life, firstly, in the form of its intrinsic nature. This is the annual plant, for in perennial plants and in trees, we meet a further complexity that necessitates different reflections. In the annual plant, you can observe the growth of a shoot from the seed, the unfolding of leaves, the further growing forth into a flower, through to fertilization and the forming of fruit containing the seeds for a subsequent plant. So here we see the outcome of the fruit, from which once more a plant develops. You will easily be able to form this picture, the plant developing from those early stages of unfolding leaf through to fertilization, developing forces that attain their culmination at the moment of fertilization. Then begins the descending trajectory as the plant fades and dies. As you reflect on this cycle, you will see the intrinsic nature of the plant. As I said, we are not now considering perennial plants and others that form a trunk, trees, which show a more complex picture than what I am saying here about annual plants that are fertilized once and then immediately approach their end. The true nature of plant nature lies specifically in a life that culminates in fertilization and then declines and fades. This is the essential nature of plant life. In seeking the essence of the plant, our search resembles our search to find the I nature of a human being within continual dying processes. We said that death, with which our physical being initially comes to an end, is always there in us as potency. The moment we are born, we begin to die. We begin, if you like, to develop death in us in incremental stages. We are dying continually. This is the dying process at work in us. In the case of the plant, what ultimately comes to culmination is also continually present. Just as we culminate in death, so the plant culminates in fertilization. Just as we grasp our inner being, our I, precisely in death, so we grasp the nature of the plant in fertilization. The plant is resurgent in fertilization. What develops as leaf is only a metamorphosis, is only a prelude to fertilization. And when you arrive at a level higher with the animal, you find that the animal is fertilized, but fertilization does not initially signify fading and dying. Fertilization can recur. Of course, we always come up against boundary questions here, but we are trying to understand life and sentience in terms of certain salient characteristics. Whereas plants, in their intrinsic nature, reach a culmination with fertilization, everyone is free, of course, to doubt whether this is the intrinsic characteristic of plants, but here we are taking plant nature in its essential manifestation. Animals do not culminate with fertilization, but overcome it. Higher animals also bear something else within them. If they only bore within them what lives in fertilization, they would have to undergo the same thing that is characteristic of plants. They would have to die away. But they bear something that goes beyond fertilization. And when we arrive at human beings, we find that they not only overcome what the animal does, but they overcome death itself. What I have said here must not be taken dogmatically, nor should it be formulated in hard and fast definitions, which will lead us up a blind alley. We should simply employ these things to elaborate ideas and concepts. If you say simply that a plant dies in fertilization and an animal retains something that goes beyond it, you are creating definitions instead of elaborating ideas. We can only gain knowledge if we attempt concepts for certain stages and levels of life and existence. And just as we must gain the concept of the I in combination with and in relation to death, so we must gain the concept of the animal by observing how fertilization is overcome in something that lives in the animal above and beyond fertilization. We have to see fertilization in the plant, what occurs in fertilization, as a continuous process. But then, having labored to develop such concepts, they come alive in our life of soul. These ideas, once we have gained them, fertilize soul life. And then, besides grasping the human I, we become able, through recognizing what stays constant in the animal, to see beyond fertilization, gradually gaining a concept of the human astral body. And if we gain an idea of what lives continuously in fertilization, we also arrive at a concept of the human etheric body. If we grasp the true I as something that rests itself free from this forming of sediments, then we have to regard the astral body differently. We have to see it as follows. Let us regard what grows, nourishes itself, reproduces itself initially, not in terms of its fading and dying. In trying to grasp the I, we see our whole physical being as dying. But now, we regard what grows, reproduces itself, not as dying, but only as subdued, continually subdued, so that now there is not anything present that vanquishes death, but something that is triumphant over the subduing and suppressing of vitality, something that revives, regenerates vitality whenever it declines. Then just as here in the drawing on page 162, we have the sparks of darkness flying from light, here, drawing page 166, we continually have something that clouds forth, if I can say that, from a shimmer of bright colors, a cloudy darkness. We have to employ such expressions to gain ideas relating to these realms of existence. So I will say, the eye sparks darkly from brightness. It clouds darkly out of it, tinging, cloudily tinging something brightly tinged. When the astral emerges from the etheric and is victorious over the subduing of vitality. I am trying to speak as precisely as possible, and you will understand that these things are not accessible to intellectual cognition, but only to imaginative perception. They cannot be expressed by intellectualized concepts, but only by imaginations. People sometimes confuse such imaginations with reality itself, and then fail to understand the response of certain critics of anthroposophy. But such people are making a mistake comparable, however paradoxical it sounds, to confusing the word hedgehog with an actual prickly hedgehog. The word hedgehog is, of course, not the hedgehog itself. Nor are these pictures the reality to which they correspond. And yet through them we can delve into the realities of supersensible existence. Such pictures render these realities in sensory terms. Those who grasp this whole process will not have to say things such as Brun says in his booklet about anthroposophy, that it confuses the supersensible with the sensory realm. That is roughly as apt as accusing a mathematician that he is confusing the numbers he writes on the blackboard with mathematics itself. But that is roughly the level at which people compose critiques of what they do not wish to understand, because they do not wish to pursue paths they would need to in order to grasp what they criticize. We have to find a way back to things that can summon the nature of the human being before our soul once more. Imaginations originally arose through breathing practices. We must now once again develop imaginations that approach the true nature of the human being. This can no longer be accomplished by a breathing process, but by processes I tried to describe in my books titled Knowledge of the Higher Worlds and titled Occult Science. So, today I wished to give a few hints about ways in which a different state of soul must be sought that does, however, arise from the modern intellectual state of soul. This other state of soul is not immediately a visionary consciousness. There is no need at all to acquire a visionary consciousness in order to develop this different state of soul. It follows from a truly intellectual interiority if we earnestly and authentically school ourselves to develop it and become aware of where its limits lie. Then it will certainly arise. We will develop it above all, will come to a recognition of an inner soul metamorphosis if we engage fully with modern scientific concepts. If we live our way into these, if we live with them, not merely humbly accepting them, but thoroughly penetrating them inwardly, they will not lead us to some ignorabimus, but instead to a threshold where this ignorabimus is otherwise usually erected. We will be led there to a distinctive experience, to a real wrestling through which this different state of soul is kindled. But everything depends here on us approaching scientific concepts with inwardly honest, absolute truthfulness. Then they will not satisfy us. Then they become seeds from which something different grows. We do not stay put with them. Do not simply look upon these scientific concepts like beans in a row on a table. But we plant these beans in the earth. That is, we plant intellectualized concepts of the natural world in the soul's inwardness, and they germinate into a new state of soul. What recent centuries have brought about bears within it the capacity to germinate new seeds of knowledge. We must look toward a new era that will reveal a new state of soul that is different from that of the age of Galileo, that of the 15th century. We must advance toward a deeper knowledge of the world by engendering within our own inwardness a keener mode of experience. End of Lecture 11, and that is the end of Collected Works, Volume 206 by Rudolf Steiner, The Human Being as Spiritual Being, Evolving Through the Course of History.